Lieutenant Colonel Chang a big thumbs up through the glass that separated the bridge from the CIC. He returned the gesture with a huge grin. I was so happy that I even turned in my chair to shake Chotek's hand, and he was grinning happily. Not so fast, monkey brains, Skippy warned. There is one minor complication. We didn't know it, but there was a ceasefire in effect between the Jarraptha and the Theranon in that subsector at that time. The Theranon have protested to the Jarraptha, and the Jarraptha have strongly denied they were involved. This could become a problem. The Jarraptha know they didn't do it, so they are wondering who did. Oh, shit. I slumped in my chair. I wouldn't worry too much about it now, Joe, Skippy said in a soothing tone. For now, both sides will almost certainly assume the incident is due to the fog of war. The Theranon do not believe the denials of the Jarraptha, so any future complication from this incident will come from the Jarraptha. And they will forget all about it eventually, as long as there are not a lot more unexplained incidents in this sector. The destruction of the Surveyor Task Force caused the Theranon to retaliate by attacking Jarraptha ships, and the ceasefire broke down entirely. It has only recently been re-established. By the way, when the Theranon violated the ceasefire by attacking the Jarraptha, they got their little green asses kicked. The Theranon very much want the current ceasefire to hold, so if we have to destroy another of their ships, they might not make a big fuss about it. Although, let's avoid taking our rebuilt pirate ship into combat unless we have to, please. Agreed. I breathed a sigh of relief, which was immediately ruined. You did not know there was a ceasefire in effect at the time you destroyed the Surveyor ship? Chotek, of course, found something to nag about. Damn it. Even in a moment of triumph, I had to defend myself. No, sir, I said, while trying to keep the annoyance out of my voice. We did not have that information at the time, and there was no time for us to attempt to gather more information. Our priority was to intercept the Surveyor ship before it topped off its fuel tanks and set course for Earth. I guess that is my bad, Skippy said cheerily. If I'd thought about it, I would have tried digging info like that out of the databanks of that tanker ship. Although I did fly by it super fast, I barely had time to get the data on the tanker ship's rendezvous with the Surveyor. Truthfully, sir, I added, if we had known about the ceasefire, that would not have changed our actions. Could not have changed our actions. We did not have the time or opportunity to consider other possibilities. As it was, we barely arrived on time at the coordinates before the Surveyor Task Force ships did. I have read your report, Colonel, Chotek said in a mildly scolding tone. The fact remains, there was a significant risk factor that you are not aware of. If the Jarraptha decide to investigate further and discover that humans were involved, then your destruction of the Surveyor Task Force could have put humanity in greater danger. We can't fly by the seat of our pants out here. The stakes are too high. Yes, sir, I responded as I could feel my cheeks growing red. Did the asshole UN bureaucrat think any of that was news to us? Hey, Skippy shouted. It's easy to play Monday morning quarterback when you have never done anything to... Skippy? I wanted to cut off a long and useless argument. Mr. Chotek has a point. We did not have all the information available at the time. Sir, I spun my command chair around to face Chotek. We are never going to have all the information we wish out here. We have to make judgments based on inadequate data. And on this mission, those judgment calls will be yours, sir. You are the mission commander. Whatever you do, someone back on Earth will be second-guessing your decisions. My little speech was more for me than for him. Following the advice of Sergeant Adams, I was not going to let fear of criticism make me shy away from doing what I thought was right. From the CIC, Adams caught my eye and gave me a subtle nod of approval. Even if the Jarraptha do find cause to investigate the destruction of the Surveyor Task Force, they will find that difficult to do, since the incident occurred in Theranon territory. It is unlikely the Theranon will stand by while enemy ships spend months running detailed sensor scans. Skippy, is there any way that either the Jarraptha or Theranon could find evidence connecting us to the Surveyor Task Force? No way, dude, he chuckled happily. You think I'm a moron? No way. Not possible. The only possibility of ever connecting humans to that incident is if human DNA was somehow on a missile casing. And that did not happen. I scrubbed those missiles before launch for that very reason. Also, if you remember, Joe, those missiles all exploded and left only subatomic particles behind. The Jarraptha and Theranon could scan that area until the end of time and not ever find a connection to us. Having said that, the Theranin do know that one of their star carriers is out here flying around by itself and is now hostile to Theranin forces. The Theranin think our pirate ship has been captured by the Kristang. I know that because the Theranin have warned the Kristang and angrily demanded their star carrier back. That caused major suspicions between Kristang clans. They are all worried that one clan has gained a major technological advantage by stealing a star carrier. The Kristang have become even more divided and distracted, I asked. That can only be good for us. That is my thinking, Joe, but then I am not a strategic genius like Count Chocula here. Chotek's face now grew red. He hated that nickname. Hated it especially since he knew the entire crew used that nickname when he wasn't around. Skippy, always being helpful, had hacked into Major Sims's logistics database before we departed Earth, and somehow 4 crates of Count Chocula breakfast cereal had been added to the supply list. We had enough Chocula cereal aboard that we simply had to eat it. Oddly enough, some people in the French team apparently loved the stuff. Most mornings, Hans Chotek could be fairly certain of seeing his namesake likeness on a box at breakfast, and someone always snickered quietly. It had to be eaten away at him. Creating a subtle daily disrespect for our UN bureaucrat was a great way to ensure that if I ever did have to mutiny and override his orders, the crew would follow me. Giving Chotek that nickname proves that Skippy is a freaking genius, and not just at physics. Sometimes I worry that he is just as good at manipulating me. Skippy, that is great news about the Surveyor ship. Have you found any data about whether the Theranin will be sending another ship to Earth? That was my greatest fear. I could not see how we could destroy a second Surveyor mission to Earth without the Theranin growing very suspicious why someone wanted to prevent ships from going to humanity's home planet. 2 missions to Earth being destroyed, along with the wormhole to Earth mysteriously shutting down, would bring unwanted attention to our little world. Maybe enough attention to get the top species like the Maxulks and Rindaloo curious and alarmed about humans. The problem of the Theranin sending a second ship had been the subject of intense study by UNEF Command before we left, and that brain trust had come up with exactly 0 realistic ideas for dealing with it. Many nights I lay in bed trying to fall asleep, but with my mind racing, trying to dream up a way to save Earth again. The only possibility I could see of stopping another Surveyor ship without exposing our secret star travel capability would be to hit the second Surveyor ship at its space dock before it ever began the mission. We would need to somehow destroy the space dock and many other ships at the same time so the Theranid would never realize the Surveyor ship had been the target. To do that, we would need a lot of nukes, and we would need to locate the space dock, get there on time, and sneak up on the target with our degraded stealth capability. That would certainly be a suicide mission for the Flying Dutchman, so we would never know if our desperate attack was successful in protecting Earth or not. Skippy answered my question. The Theranin have notified the Fire Dragon Clan Kristang that their hired Surveyor ship was destroyed in the course of its mission, so the Theranin are invoking the Catastrophic Loss Clause of the contract and refunding only a small part of the payment. They also... This is funny. They told the Fire Dragons that they should have paid extra for insurance. That wasn't a joke, by the way. The Little Green Men did actually offer to sell insurance to the Fire Dragons, but the Lizards couldn't afford it. So there won't be a second Surveyor ship mission to Earth? I asked fearfully. Not any time soon, no, Skippy confirmed. Loss of the Surveyor ship has caused the Theranin to jack up the price of a second mission, above anything the Fire Dragons can afford to pay. There are rumors of the Fire Dragons attempting to create a coalition to raise the money, but if the Fire Dragons are able to create a coalition, then they would be able to avoid the civil war that is the entire purpose of sending a ship to Earth in the first place. There will be a meeting of Kristang clans later this year. That is when the Fire Dragons hope to propose a coalition. There is another factor to consider, Joe. What's that? Good news, I fervently wished. Good news, only good news. Skippy read my mind, although he said he couldn't do that. Good news this time. The Theranin have been hurt badly by the Giratha in this sector. They are not eager for the distraction of another long mission to Earth. A recent loss of territory to the Giratha means that any mission to Earth would need to detour around a key wormhole cluster, and that would add another 7-week round trip to an already very long mission. The voyage to Earth was previously near the limit of a Surveyor ship's performance characteristics. The detour makes it almost dangerous. In the relay's databanks, I found a message from the shipyard that designed the current class of Surveyors. That shipyard warned they cannot be held responsible for anyone pushing their ships past their design limits. That is good news. It is most certainly good news, Colonel Joe, Skippy said happily. With such good news, I wanted to plan a celebration for the crew. Given the people we lost in taking the relay station, a memorial service was more appropriate. Did you learn anything else? My priority was searching for data about the Surveyor Task Force. I am combing through the rest of the databanks now. The data is poorly organized. The Theranin should be ashamed of themselves. It's going to take a while, Joe, even for me. We did get what we came for, so mission accomplished. Sir, I turned to Chotek, who still managed to look unhappy despite the very welcome good news. We have secured the relay station, and a Theranin relief crew is not scheduled to arrive for 11 months. I suggest we clean up exterior damage to maintain the ruse that the station is operating normally. Then we should back the Dutchman away and remain in the area until we receive confirmation the Theranin will not send a second mission to Earth. Hanging near the relay station with the Dutchman drifting stealthily in interstellar space for months was going to be extremely dull for the crew. I agree for now, Colonel, Chotek said stiffly. Please assure us a self-destruct mechanism is installed aboard the relay station. The self-destruct mechanism he referred to was a pair of our own self-destruct nukes. Right away, sir. Colonel Chang, please inform the crew they can stand down from battle stations, and assign a party to bring our party favors, I meant the nukes, to the station. I was going to our sick bay to see how Dr. Skippy was caring for our wounded. On the way to sick bay, Skippy called my Z-phone. Good news about the relay station, Joe, Skippy reported. Their sick bay has a full supply of medical nanomachines, so we can replenish our supply. A relay station does not carry a large quantity of medical supplies compared to a star carrier, so we will still have only 28% of what we started with. The station, unfortunately, has almost none of the more useful multipurpose engineering nanomachines. There are some station components that we could use as spare parts aboard the Dutchman. The components need to remain in place for now for the station to function properly. We can remove them later. Oh, also, there are 2 dropships in the docking bay of the same 2 types we have. That news excited me. 2 more dropships. That's great, Skippy. Can we bring them aboard now? I need to check them out thoroughly first. Their maintenance records indicate they work fine, but you know that you should never buy a used dropship without having it inspected first. We don't want to fall for that dipstick trick like your cousin Jimmy did. Oh, yeah. When my cousin Jimmy got his first job, he bought an old pickup truck. It was beat up and looked like a piece of junk. But Jimmy pulled the dipstick, and it had plenty of clean, new oil. The next morning, there was a puddle of nasty black oil in his driveway, and 3 days later, the engine seized. The guy he bought it from had put a plug at the bottom of the dipstick tube, put in just enough fresh oil to make it look good. Since then, whenever poor Jimmy bought anything, we always asked whether he had checked the dipstick. How did you hear about that? Your cousins were talking about it at the party when you came home this time. You need to go more often. I hear the best stories when you're there. I'm working on it, Skippy. Need to save the world again first. There were only 3 people in the sick bay when I arrived. The power of advanced weaponry and the extreme violence of future combat left few lucky enough to be wounded. 4 injury cases had already been tended to by Dr. Skippy. 2 of those were in recovery tanks with serious internal injuries that Skippy was hopeful could be cured. The other 2 were resting in their own quarters. Lieutenant Kwan was missing an arm. The other soldier had lost most of her right leg. Skippy was 100% confident that they both would make a full recovery, although he told me privately that the supply of nanomachines for Theranin medicine were running low. To repair the Dutchman on our last mission, Skippy had used up 90% of the medical nano, repurposing the tiny devices to repair the ship instead of body parts. We should, he said, hopefully be able to partly replenish our nanomachine supply from the relay station. Still, we needed to be careful with the supply of these critical medical miracles. Human injuries that could heal naturally or with mere drugs and surgery would skip the advantage of nanomachines. I greeted the 3 less seriously injured people awaiting treatment in the sick bay, including Ranger Lauren Poole. She had a black eye, several cuts on her face, and an ugly purple bruise from her right hip to her ribs. Colonel, she said as she saluted me. I could tell raising her right arm was painful. Lieutenant Poole, I looked at the deep bruise. That looks bad. It's fine, sir, she replied. I'm here for my ankle. She lifted her right leg and I could see that her ankle was hanging oddly.
I feel stupid, sir. All those years in gymnastics, practicing landings, and I sprain my ankle now.
She took 3 Theranin rounds to her suit leg, and her ankle is broken, not sprained, Major Smythe explained. You are lucky to be alive, Lieutenant, he said with obvious pride about the toughness of his Spec Ops team.
Ricochet, sir, she said with a shrug. The only direct hit was to my torso.
She pointed to the ugly bruise.
Those Kristang armored suits are tough. The black eye, she indicated her face, and I noticed she used her left hand, is because a tiny piece of shrapnel punctured my visor. It sealed right away, or I wouldn't be here.
Correct, Dr. Skippy's voice said from a wall speaker. Your injuries are not serious enough to require extensive use of nanomachines, so you will have surgery shortly and regular injections of healing drugs.
I'll be fine, Mr. Skippy, she said with a grimace. I don't need surgery if someone else is in greater need of it.
Ankle injuries are nothing new, Lieutenant, I interrupted. If Dr. Skippy says you need surgery, then you will cooperate to the best of your ability. Then you're going to follow the letter and spirit of the rehab routine that Dr. Skippy sets up for you, I declared. I expect nothing less than perfection when you are performing rehabilitation exercises. All the judges had better be holding up cards with 10 on them. Is that understood?
Yes, sir, Poole said with a grin.
I had given her a challenge, and there is nothing Special Forces people like more than a challenge.
I'll be up and around soon. You'll see.
Skippy and Smythe politely shooed me out of sickbay as soon as they could. The last thing they wanted was the commanding officer hanging around and making everyone uncomfortable. Taking the unsubtle hint to go away, I headed to the galley for a snack. A cup of coffee and half a blueberry muffin took the edge off, and I was sitting at a table reading reports on my tablet when Skippy called me through the ceiling speaker.
Hey, Colonel Joe, I, found something interesting in the relay station's databanks. It seems there is trouble in paradise, or should I say trouble on paradise?
Skippy, I stood up abruptly, alarmed.
We should talk about this in my office, sir.
Adams had been pouring herself a cup of coffee. That woman had the worst sense of timing. Or maybe the best. The 10 other people in the galley all looked at her expectantly.
Is there a reason we can't hear information about the situation on Paradise?
Adams, I was annoyed and embarrassed. If this is bad news for UNEF, and we aren't able to do anything about it, I do not see the point of everyone bearing that burden.
She set her coffee cup down and crossed her arms.
That was not a good sign for me.
When my aunt found out she had cancer, she didn't tell the family because she said she didn't want to worry anyone. She was wrong about that. If you shut us out, you're wrong also.
Sir. Her message was loud and clear. The merry band of pirates may not always be merry, but they were adults. They deserve to know. What pissed me off is that Skippy knew how I felt about keeping information about Paradise quiet, yet he had blurted it out while I was in a room with people. That irritating little beer can had done it deliberately.
Skippy, I said as I sat back down.
Let's hear it.
I found something unexpected. 2 things, actually. First, the Ruhar federal government has been negotiating to give Paradise back to the Kristang.
His voice was drowned out by a chorus of shouts from everyone in the galley, including me.
People, quiet, please. Oh my God.
I was completely stunned.
Until that moment, my greatest fear had been that the Ruhar might not be able to supply enough food for UNEF. I had not thought the Ruhar would actively abuse the humans on their planet, and it had never for 1 second crossed my mind that the Ruhar would sell the planet out from under UNEF feet.
Skippy, why the hell would the hamsters do that? They fought for Paradise.
Right then, I thought of all the Ruhar who had died when I shot down the 2 whale transports they were in, and the Ruhar had planned that operation and risked all those lives as a feint to lure in a Theranin task force so the Giraptha could destroy it. Now all those lives would truly be wasted.
Skippy explained the Ruhar's reasons for not wishing to keep Paradise, that it was not conveniently located following the recent wormhole shift, that the Kristang were offering more valuable territory in exchange for Paradise, that securing Paradise would require a major commitment to fleet resources that were needed elsewhere, an expense the Ruhar were not willing to bear, that the Ruhar had not wanted or intended to take the planet back recently, and now it was merely a bargaining chip for them.
Not all of the Ruhar agree with giving Paradise away, Joe, Skippy tried to assure us.
The native population, and of course UNEF, know nothing about negotiations with the Kristang. Your old friend Baturna Logelia, the Burgermeister, is personally opposed to trading away her home. Hearing that name brought back a flood of memories. Sitting in Lester Cornhut's home, on the Cornhut family couch, sipping tea with the Burgermeister. Listening while she told me horror stories of how humanity had been betrayed by the species we considered saviors and allies. Listening while she destroyed the last of my innocence. Innocence was a luxury I couldn't afford. The days sitting on that couch seemed a lifetime ago now, like those events had happened to a different person. They had. I was a different person back then. A brand new buck sergeant, learning to lead a new fire team on an alien planet, constantly scared of screwing up. Now I was a colonel, with the blood of thousands of aliens on my hands, and a home world that had been saved twice. And I was still constantly scared of screwing up. Can she do anything to help UNEF? The Burgermeister, I mean. Nothing substantial that I can see now, Joe. I am sorry. She is still the deputy administrator of the planet. However, the decisions are being made off-world. She has petitioned the Ruha federal government to include the humans on Paradise in the evacuation when the planet is formally returned to the Kristang. The government has formally and very strongly rejected that idea. Humans, the government stated, are legally enemies of the Ruha, and therefore their fate is not a problem for the Ruha. Shit, I breathed slowly. Just when I thought things were going well. Don, then this is a particularly bad time for me to mention that I have more bad news? Somehow I resisted the temptation to pound the table. Sure, Skippy, go ahead. Why the hell not? Okay, I sense some irritation in your voice, Joe. You think? Skippy ignored me. The stalled negotiations between the Ruha and Kristang were recently disrupted by a Kristang battle group that jumped into orbit 3 weeks ago. One of their ships were destroyed by the Ruha, but the Kristang have now established space supremacy around Paradise. Their ships have complete control of the skies. After the brief initial battle, a truce has been arranged. The Kristang have landed almost 4,000 troops with aircraft and heavy equipment. So far, according to the data available, the Kristang have not directly engaged UNEF. That is good, for UNEF is totally disarmed and defenseless. I must warn that the data I have is 14 days old at this point. How the hell did this happen? The last intel you provided, you said the Theranin were pulling away from Paradise, that they would not support future Kristang efforts to keep the place. That intelligence was and still is accurate. The Theranin do not see any value in a primarily agricultural planet. Therefore, if the Kristang wish to pursue recapture of Paradise, they will do so on their own. The Kristang Swift Arrow Clan strongly desires to retake the planet. So they have paid full price plus combat bonuses for the Theranin to provide transport to the Paradise system. Going to Paradise was a one-way trip for the Swift Arrow Battle Group, Joe. They can't afford to have all their ships transported back home. The crews of those ships are very committed. They know they can't go home. That reminded me of history I had learned in high school. When Hernan Cortez invaded Mexico, he scuttled his ships behind him so his men would have no alternative but to conquer the Aztec Empire. When I read that in history class, I thought that Cortez was a reckless fool. Now I considered that scuttling his ships may have been an act of desperation. If the Kristang on Paradise faced a similar situation, they would be very dangerous. This is bad news, I said with a sigh. Do you have anything worse? Nope, Joe, he said with clueless cheeriness in his voice. That's all the bad news for now. Great. To avoid rumors flying around, I looked at the people in the galley. Send your data to the entire crew. I need to talk with Chotek and Chang right away. As I was leaving the cafeteria, I passed by Sergeant Adams, who was gulping a hot coffee and getting ready to bolt out the door. Adams.
Yes, sir.
Your aunt. How is she?
Fine. She has been in remission for 7 years now. But she went through a lot of pain alone, and she didn't need to. We're family. We support each other.
I got a message. By family, she meant the merry band of pirates in UNEF. Let's hope there is something useful we can do to support UNEF. To avoid exposure, we can't even send them a sympathy card, I added bitterly. Chapter 13 I quickly called together the senior military staff, plus Dr. Friedlander of the science team, to meet with me and Chotek, and of course Skippy. Chotek had already heard the bad news from Skippy before I was able to talk with him. I had anticipated an argument with the UN bureaucrat. Instead, to my relief, he agreed we needed to discuss this situation and see if there was anything we could do to assist UNEF. Everyone has heard that a Kristang battle group currently has space superiority above Paradise? Everyone around the briefing table nodded. The Kristang being back in control there poses an unacceptable risk to UNEF on Paradise, and we need to determine whether there is something we can do about the situation. Something we can do, I glanced over at Chotek, without exposing our presence. Skippy, let's start with you. I want a way for us to assist UNEF on Paradise. Ugh, Skippy groaned. Half the time when you're talking, Joe, I have to guess what you are truly trying to say through a jumble of blah, 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 while you ramble around the point. It would help if you were more specific, Joe. Not only would it help me, it would help your own murky thinking process if you could define exactly what you want to accomplish. What I want, I said very slowly to give me time to think, is... What did I want? I wanted Skippy to magically beam every human on Paradise back to Earth, but he couldn't do that. I knew that because I had already asked him, and he told me no. He also said he hoped I had been joking about that. I was, sort of. Mostly. So what did I want? I wanted UNEF to be safe. Safer. Relatively safe. That meant, unfortunately, making sure the Ruha kept control of Paradise. The fragile ceasefire on Paradise was the only thing keeping the Kristang from taking revenge on humans they considered traitors. If the Kristang had unchallenged control of the planet, they could slaughter and enslave humans with complete impunity. None of the rules that govern combat between the Maxolks and Rindaloo factions protected client species from being abused by their patrons. Great. All I needed to do was to somehow arrange events so that a powerful star-faring species maintained control of a planet they didn't want in order for them to protect humans who the Ruha wished would just go away. And arrange events without the Kristang, Ruha, or UNEF ever knowing we were ever there. Easy. Hey, we'd already saved Earth twice. How difficult could this be? Think, Joe. Think, I told myself. Break the problem down into manageable pieces, then solve each piece. Think of the problem as an enemy and defeat them in detail. The situation had been much more favorable to us having a chance to influence events before the Kristang battlegroup arrived and established space superiority around Paradise. With the battlegroup in firm control, the default situation was the Kristang merely needing to hang on until the Ruhar eventually grew tired, negotiated a settlement, and evacuated the planet. Before the Kristang battlegroup surprisingly jumped into orbit, the Ruhar could have kept the planet or not. It was their choice. We needed to make continued possession of Paradise the Ruhar's choice again. We needed to eliminate that Kristang battlegroup. Here's what I want. A way to take out that Kristang battlegroup in a way that the Kristang and the Ruhar don't know we are involved. Without that battlegroup, the Kristang will not be in such a strong position to negotiate to get Paradise back. Without that battlegroup, the Ruhar can drive a hard bargain on Paradise, and maybe the Kristang won't be able to offer a sweet enough deal. Maybe the Ruhar won't be tempted by the Kristang's offer and they keep the planet. Maybe there is even something we can do behind the scenes to make the Ruhar decide to keep Paradise. Without that battlegroup, UNEF isn't in immediate danger of being wiped out. As long as that battlegroup is in orbit, the Kristang have the upper hand in negotiations, and the Ruhar are much more likely to surrender the planet permanently. That is the simplest way to state the problem, Skippy. No magical beaming UNEF back to Earth, just a simple military problem. Find a way to deal with that battlegroup. Simple. Skippy's voice was incredulous. You think that is simple? Unbelievable. Over 20 Kristang warships, not to mention their support ships. Opposing them are a handful of Ruhar warships and our pirate ship. We can't really count the Flying Dutchman as a combat asset because we can't openly engage in combat. Also, you need to remember that our pirate ship is pretty beat up. We would have difficulty directly engaging those Kristang cruisers or even a pair of destroyers. I didn't say it would be simple. We understand that we are facing a substantial combat force and we need to take them out of the equation. When you say deal with or take out that battle group, Skippy interrupted, you really mean destroy those ships, right? Is that what you want? It would be super helpful if you got straight to the point, Colonel Joe. Yes, I suppressed a sigh. Skippy was being extra difficult today. I want to destroy all or a substantial part of that battle group's combat power. That means destroying those ships, or at least knocking out their weapons. If we can reduce the battle group's combat power, if we can even the odds, then the Ruha may decide it is worth sending reinforcements. Right now, the Ruha fleet doesn't want to commit the number of ships that would be required to take on the Kristang. The Ruha aren't willing to commit that many ships to reestablish control of a planet they are trying to negotiate away. If we can somehow even the odds so it is tempting for the Ruha to retake the planet, then they may come back, even if it is only so they will have greater bargaining power in giving away the planet.
Then we'll be right back to the problem of the Ruha selling the planet out from under UNEF, Chang reminded me.
Yes, but that is not the immediate problem. We need to first deal with the Kristang having unchallenged control over the planet, bring the situation back to equilibrium.
I surprised myself for using that word. Where had I learned that?
If the odds are back to even between the Ruha and the Kristang, there might be something we can do to influence the negotiations for transfer and control of the planet. Right now, we don't have that option.
Well then, Joe, Skippy mused. You have finally framed the actual objective, destroying the Kristang battle group. Now I can start thinking about how to do that.
Great. Is this where you go silent and your little beer can gets warm while you crunch like a trillion variables?
Please, Joe. Way more than a trillion, he snorted derisively.
Understood. Can I assume you can't do something simple like use the Thorena nanovirus to seize control of those Kristang ships?
Duh.
No, Joe, I would have mentioned that right away. Nope, I can't do that this time. Even my awesome powers are only able to activate the nanovirus on 3 ships at one time because of the distances involved in space combat. Also, the Kristang Task Force is wisely dispersed far around Paradise. I could only get a maximum of 4 ships within range from any particular point in space. So, using the nanovirus is impractical. The reason that trick worked when we first arrived at Earth is those 2 Kristang ships were relatively close to where we jumped in. Here, if we jumped into low orbit, I could only activate the nanovirus on 3 ships. The other 17 warships would see what happened, and we would never be able to use that trick again. The Theranin would also lose the secrecy of the nanovirus being embedded aboard Kristang ships, although I don't think any of us will be weeping for those little green pinheads. Remember, Joe, the Theranin designed the nanovirus for the purpose of taking control of Kristang ships at the time they are attached to a Theranin star carrier. It is a short-range technology. And in case you're thinking we can jump in far away from Paradise and sneak up on the Kristang in normal space, forget about it. When I rebuilt the Dutchman, I wasn't able to bring our stealth capability back to full effectiveness due to lack of the proper raw materials. Even the Kristang's crappy sensors would eventually detect this large ship sneaking around in Paradise orbit.
Understood, Skippy, I said with a frown. The truth was I had been hoping he could use the nanovirus trick in some way. And again, thank you. You did a remarkable job rebuilding the ship out of moondust. The Merry Band of Pirates does appreciate it more than we can say.
All right, Mr. Chotek. At this point, I think we let Skippy consider our options, while my staff also tries to think of a strategy to destroy all or most of the Kristang battle group around Paradise. Chotek nodded agreement.
These military matters are your area of expertise, Colonel Bishop. Mr. Skippy, I am sure your incredible brain power will develop a range of innovative solutions for us to consider.
Working on it right now, Skippy acknowledged. Although I don't know why you can't simply use the projectors. That's why I have difficulty understanding your concepts of military strategy. You don't take advantage of the easiest...
What projectors? Chang asked before I could open my mouth.
The Terawatt Maser Cannon projectors buried beneath the surface of Paradise, duh, Skippy explained.
Damn, you monkeys are especially dense sometimes. Like a neutron star, only not as smart, and more smelly.
Chang and I shared a dumbfounded look. I was the first to speak.
There are giant maser cannons on Paradise? Why haven't the Ruha used them against the Kristang?
Yes, there are maser cannons.
Big ones.
Skippy's voice carried a mocking tone.
Cannons capable of delivering over 10 terawatts in a single shot. Cannons like that can burn right through a starship's shields, especially if the shield is close, like in orbit.
To answer your moronic question, the Ruha can't use the projectors because they don't know about them.
Man, do you even listen to yourself talk sometimes?
Maybe hearing your own stupidity is too painful for...
Skippy, I shouted in frustration. I did not know about any projectors. Are these projectors something UNEF built?
Huh?
Wow. This is truly a breakthrough. Joe, that may be the dumbest thing you ever said. We should have a cake to celebrate the occasion. A banana cake. UNEF, constructing maser cannons. Out of what? Mud and sticks? No, UNEF was not involved. They also have no idea there are powerful planetary defense cannons beneath their feet. The Kristang installed those projectors, Joe. And what do you mean you didn't know about them? I told you all about it, like a long time... I'm sure I did. Did I? Oh, boy. His voice trailed off. I'm sure that I told somebody. Or maybe not. Anyway, you know about it now, so we're good. Yep, goodness all around. While Chang buried his head in his hands, I mimed choking something. Skippy, if you had a neck, I'd choke you. How can you forget to tell us something that important? Hey, there is a ginormous amount of data rattling around in my brain, Joe. I can't keep track of everything you monkeys don't know, he grumbled. Everything you don't know would fit inside the freaking galaxy. Chotek took a deep breath. Colonel Bishop, I am beginning to see the difficulties you have in working with our super-smart alien friend. Oh, shut up, Count Chocula, Skippy said defensively. Anywho, Joe, you know now. Details, Skippy, I said quietly. We could use some details. What you said doesn't make sense. If the Kristang installed those projectors, how are we supposed to use them? And why didn't the Kristang use them against the Ruha ships in orbit? And I would like to know, Chang asked. How could the Ruha not know about these weapons? The Ruha have occupied this planet for... Ugh! Skippy groaned. Damn it, if you will stop pestering me with ignorant questions, I will attempt to smack some knowledge on you. I'm not confident that it will be successful, but I am willing to give it my best shot. We would appreciate being smacked down upon, O Great One, I said sarcastically. Assuming that was not an attempt at sarcasm, Joe... Here is the story. The Kristang clan that originally settled this planet installed the projectors to protect their assets, mostly from other Kristang clans. When that original Black Tree clan lost the planet to the Ruhar, they put the projectors into a dormant mode and did not tell any other clans about the projectors in case the Black Tree clan has an opportunity to come back. They didn't want their own maser cannons being used against them. I had to shake my head to make sure I wasn't having a bad dream. These projectors have been buried beneath the surface all this time. Why didn't the Black Tree use their maser cannons to stop the Ruha from taking paradise away from them in the first place? Again, with the stupid questions, Joe, Skippy chided me. The reason the Black Tree lost paradise was because the Kristang and Theranin were defeated in a major fleet engagement elsewhere in the sector. By the time the Ruha task force first jumped into the skies above paradise, the fighting was over. The Black Tree clan handing over paradise was a mere formality at that point. There was no space combat near the paradise system. So, they gave up the planet meekly, while keeping their aces in the hole concealed. The Black Trees originally came to paradise in order to excavate the remains of a crashed Elder ship, and by the time the Ruhar arrived, the Black Trees were fairly certain they had already taken away all the valuable artifacts. Ha! They didn't know anything about me, stupid lizards! Serves them right! He paused. Wow. I'm not going to be interrupted with moronic questions. Amazing. So, to respond to your other inquiries, neither the current Kristang Swift Arrow Clan nor the Ruha know anything about the projectors. Neither of them even suspect. At the time that the Ruha first arrived there, the Kristang population was less than 10,000, and the Black Tree's presence there was already in the process of winding down. The Ruha never thought the Black Trees would go through the expense of constructing anti-ship defenses on such an unimportant planet. Why did they? Chotek asked. Because, Skippy explained without pausing for an insult, almost the first item the Black Tree found here was a functional Elder power tap. That is one of the most valuable items in the entire galaxy. As soon as they found that, they hoped they would find others, so they installed projectors to protect their investment. Of course, they never told the Swift Arrows or any other clans. The projectors are buried deeply, roughly 100 meters, and each is surrounded by a special type of stealth field. Any sensor scans by the Kristang or Ruha would find only rock or whatever material surrounds the projectors. The projectors are also located in areas that are unsuited to agriculture. The Black Trees thought ahead far enough to consider another group may someday build farms and villages on Paradise. They didn't want someone to accidentally discover a projector by digging a foundation or a well.
For a minute, you could have heard a pin drop around the conference room while we all considered the enormity of what Skippy had revealed. Sergeant Adams, ever focused on practical issues, broke the silence.
Skipster, she addressed him by the nickname only she could get away with, you said we could use the projectors. Is this something simple that you can hook up remotely from the Dutchman?
Finally! An intelligent question!
Skippy sounded pleased. You could learn from Sergeant Adams, Joe. You have grown substantially dumber since putting those Colonel's Eagles on your uniform.
No, Sarge Marge, Skippy said teasingly, using the nickname that only he could get away with.
Before the Black Trees left the planet, they put the projectors into dormancy, anticipating it might be hundreds or even a thousand years before the Black Trees might return. They disconnected each projector from its power source and from the control module, specifically so an enemy could not remotely activate a projector. Restoring projectors to function will require someone to physically re-establish connections. Once the connections are established, I can program their targeting sensors through something as simple as a Z-phone network.
We will need to go down to the surface, Adams concluded.
Chotek held up a hand. Sergeant, sending a party to the surface of Paradise, presumably to excavate these projectors, would pose a substantial risk of exposure to us. That is something I cannot authorize. He shook his head, but he didn't look us in the eyes when he said that.
Sir, I said with a warning look at Adams, whose jaw was already clenching.
I believe there is an alternative that does not pose a risk of exposure to us, or it poses a minimal, very manageable risk. We do not need to send a party to the surface. UNEF is already there. They can reactivate the projectors for us. All we need to do is determine a method for informing them about the projectors and provide instructions for bringing them back online.
Chotek frowned.
I do not understand why we could not simply inform the Ruha about the projectors and let them deal with the Kristang. Surely, between the projectors and their remaining ships, the Ruha here would regain the upper hand.
Whoa! That is a terrible, terribly awful idea there, Chocula,
Skippy said scoffingly. The Ruha's communications have been partially compromised by the Kristang. We can't tell the hamsters because that poses too much risk of the Swift Era Kristang learning the secret.
I also think, sir, that we can't trust the Ruha to deliver the outcome we desire. I used big buzzwords that Chotek was used to.
The Ruha might merely reactivate the projectors and use them to threaten the Kristang, to strengthen their hand in negotiations to hand the planet to the Kristang. What we need, sir, is a shooting war between the Ruha and the Kristang here. If a small UNEF group could reactivate projectors and we use them to destroy most of the Swift Arrow's battle group, that will force the Ruha to take military action. It would change the balance of power, sir.
Then we might be right back to the situation before the Swift Arrow task force arrived, Colonel, Chotek responded. With the Ruha in a strong position to negotiate, but still in the process of negotiating the planet away beneath UNEF.
That is possible, sir, I explained patiently. The way I look at it, with the Swift Arrow battle group in control of the skies, we have no options. Without that battle group, we may be able to affect the outcome.
Affect it how? Chotek asked. We still have the constraint of avoiding exposure.
Avoiding exposure is paramount, I agreed. Right now, I don't know how we may be able to assist UNEF. But 5 minutes ago, we didn't know there was a way for us to destroy a Kristang battle group, I pointed out. One thing I have learned out here is almost anything is possible. We will have plenty of time to develop ideas before the situation on Paradise restabilizes, hopefully with the Ruha firmly back in control. A friendly local UN bureaucrat pursed his lips and thought.
Before any action is taken, Colonel, I will need to see a detailed plan. We will have to assess the risks.
To be clear, he stopped me before I could respond. We have to weigh the risk of exposure. He ticked the risks off on his fingers. The risk to our primary objective. And, Colonel, the risk that our operation may fail and the blowback to our people on Paradise makes the situation worse for them.
Understood, I said, and I actually fully agreed with him. If either the Ruha or Kristang learned that human troops were secretly traveling around Paradise reactivating maser cannons, the impact to UNEF could be severe. And once those cannons fired, I don't see how the Ruha could fail to figure out the humans had forced them into a shooting war. After that, the humans there may be in as much danger from the Ruha as from the Kristang.
Skippy, please provide a briefing packet about the projectors, capabilities, operational characteristics, the procedure for reactivating them, etc. Distribute the data to the entire crew, including the science team. We need everyone involved in the planning. Unit leaders, I addressed the Spec Ops team commanders, but especially Major Smythe. Read the briefing packet and put your thinking caps on. We have 9 days until we will be within jump range of the Paradise system, and we still need to stay here for a while. We can't leave this relay station until Skippy is satisfied his submind is properly installed and operating properly. And we need to complete repairs to the exterior of the station to maintain our ruse. Everyone, thank you, and... Wait. Skippy, what else have you not told us?
Ugh. Since I don't know what it is that you don't know. The scope of your ignorance, I can't guess what I haven't told you. There is nothing anywhere near as important as secret maser cannons, I'm sure of that.
Good. Skippy's words had not reassured me. If you think of anything else, call me immediately.
I'd prefer to wait until you're in the bathroom like usual, but for this I can break with tradition, Joe.
Paradise.
Flight Leader Second Class Saley Chernendegren climbed into her two-seater Dobra fighter, the type of aircraft that humans had derisively named Chicken. On the home planet of the Ruhar, a Dobra was a fierce bird of prey, an animal to be feared in the air. Saley had not understood why the humans had renamed the aircraft after a tame, domesticated bird, other than the fact that humans were strange, and no Ruhar could truly understand such primitive creatures. As Saley attached her oxygen mask, she pressed a button, and the soft surface of the mask flowed around her nose and mouth, forming a secure seal, even over the Ruhar fur that covered her face. Human male pilots, she knew, had to scrape the fur off their faces every morning in order to get a good seal on an oxygen mask. Ruhar males grew hair on their faces also, but it was a soft, downy fur, rather than the bushy tangle that humans could grow. Humans were strange creatures, Saley thought, as she draped her arms over each side of the cockpit to show the ground crew that she was not yet touching any of the controls. Strange, and in many ways to be pitied. They had barely achieved a rudimentary form of spaceflight when they were forced into the war by the wormhole shift. Then they were brought out to the stars as expendable ground troops by their allies, the Kristang. Saley had been born and raised on Gitanu, the world called Paradise by the humans. Along with all Ruhar, she had resented human soldiers landing on her planet and forcing her people off the world that was their home. She had hated the humans, even after Saley's commanding officer noted that having humans handle the evacuation was far better than the task being managed by the cruel and untrustworthy Kristang. Some of the humans could say nasty things, but most of them had been professional, simply eager to do their jobs and go home as quickly as possible. The human leadership had been scrupulous about adhering to the code of conduct established between the Ruhar and Kristang for the evacuation. There had been remarkably few incidents of violence directed at Ruhar civilians by humans. Remarkable indeed, because humans believed the Ruhar had attacked their home world in order to enslave and destroy humanity. If the situation had been reversed, Saley did not know whether she would have been able to restrain herself. Since the humans had first landed, Saley had many opportunities to meet humans and even to spend extensive time with them. Human pilots had arrived on Gitanu with an average of 120 hours of flight training in Ruhar aircraft, having been given a rush course at some interim staging base. For pilots who would fly the high-performance Dobra gunships, most of them had less than 20 hours in that type. Humans had arrived in a potential combat zone with woefully inadequate flying experience, and they knew it. The human commander had quickly reached an agreement with the Ruhar leadership on Gitanu for Ruhar pilots to continue the training of human pilots. The agreement had been mutually beneficial. The humans gained valuable experience from experts, and the Ruhar pilots kept their own skills from growing rusty. Keeping their flying skills fresh had proved useful when the Ruhar fleet came back to take control of the planet again. Now that a Kristang battle group was in orbit, and the Kristang had landed combat aircraft and ground troops, Saley was especially grateful that her connection with the high-performance Dobra was still instinctive. One of the human pilots she had trained was still at the airbase, now on her ground crew. He was Lieutenant Derek Bonsu of the American Army. Lieutenant was roughly equivalent to the Ruhar rank of Flyer First Class, 2 steps below Saley's own rank. The fact that Derek, as she called him, was an American seemed to be important to him, but meaningless to Sally or any other Ruhar. The Ruhar species had a half-dozen major cultural groups with slightly different languages, but their military was one cohesive unit. The idea that soldiers who fought side by side could owe allegiance to different governments was odd to the Ruhar. Indeed, it seemed similar to the clan culture of the Kristang. With the Kristang expending more time, effort, and passion fighting among themselves than fighting their mutual enemies, the Ruhar had been able to defeat them in almost every major engagement of their endless war, even though the Kristang economy and culture was almost entirely dedicated to supporting the war. Another thing the Ruhar found odd about humans was the different colors of their skin. In this regard, humans were also more similar to the Kristang, whose scales had many hues. Derek Bonsu's own skin was dark. He had once explained with pride that his ancestors came from a place called Africa, which again meant nothing to Saley. All Ruhar had the same pinkish-beige skin tone. It was their fur color that varied. Saley's own fur was white with patches of light brown, and fur color was neither a fashion choice nor a cultural marker for the Ruhar. She kept the fur on her head long. For flying or athletic activities, she tied her fur back in what humans called a short ponytail. The ground crew leader signaled that Saley could close her canopy and turn on the master power switch, which she did. Her weapons systems officer in the back seat announced that all of the ship's systems were ready for engine start, and she confirmed from her own instruments. Before signaling the crew chief that she was ready for engine start, she turned in her seat to look back along both sides of the aircraft. On the left side was Lieutenant Derek Bonsu with the external power cart. Saley liked Derek, although he had come to Gitanu as an enemy. Derek had an infectious grin and never complained, even when eating bland, nutrient mush 2 times a day. On the rare occasions when he received a care package of real human food from Lemuria, he treated every tomato or loaf of bread as if it were the most precious gift in the universe. Even when the Kristang battle group jumped in and took back control of the planet, Bonsu had not lost his good-natured grin for a moment. The planet had changed management several times already, Bonsu had said about the current Kristang mastery of the skies. Next week, the Ruhar fleet might get bored elsewhere in the sector and come to Gitanu to chase the Kristang away. Bonsu said no one knew what the future held, so why waste energy worrying about what you couldn't control? Along with the sunny disposition that made him popular even among Ruhar who did not like humans, Bonsu had other qualities. He had made a serious effort right from the start to learn the Ruhar common language. It helped his popularity that the first words he learned were common swear words, and soon he was cursing fluently in Ruhar. Saley noticed that now, whenever a wrench slipped and Bonsu bashed his knuckles, he cursed in Ruhar without thinking about it. But the ultimate reason Derek Bonsu was working at a Ruhar airbase instead of farming in Lemuria with his fellow humans was that he loved flying. When the Ruhar fleet had jumped in and firmly established control of the planet, their United Nations Expeditionary Force headquarters had quickly ordered all units to surrender, the alternative being for human forces to be pounded from orbit by masers and railguns. Most human pilots had flown to the nearest airbase and abandoned their ships immediately. Some pilots had set their aircraft down in remote areas near clusters of human ground troops. Some chicken crews had even spitefully ejected from their ships, causing complete loss of the aircraft. Lieutenant Derek Bonsu had calmly flown his Dobra back to its home base, bringing it down in front of his designated hangar. Bonsu had followed the guidebook's recommended procedure for engine shutdown, allowing the engines to run at idle for 3 minutes to cool before cutting power. He and his weapon systems officer had then refueled and secured the aircraft, placing covers over the intakes and hanging red tags from items that needed to be checked during pre-flight inspection. He had properly listed minor issues in the aircraft's official squawk log, noting that the nose landing gear door was slow to open and that the right engine surged for a few seconds when throttling above 80% power. Lastly, Bonsu had vacuumed out the cockpit and wiped down the display screens. That particular Dobra became Saley's assigned aircraft, and she appreciated the care Bonsu had taken with her aircraft. Such good care that her Dobra was the first to return to flight status when the Ruhar had reoccupied the airbase. All those characteristics were reasons why Lieutenant Derek Bonsu had been one of only 4 humans invited to remain at the airbase as liaisons with the Ruhar. None of the 4 humans were allowed to fly regularly, except for brief proficiency check flights every 2 months. Otherwise, the humans worked alongside Ruhar aircraft maintenance crews, and the humans took every minute of flight simulator time they could get, even waking up in the early hours of the morning to avoid taking precious simulator time away from the Ruhar pilots. At first, the maintenance crews had assigned the four humans only humiliating tasks, such as keeping the hangar floors clean and other menial work. Even now that the humans had earned the respect of the base personnel, a Ruhar was required to inspect and sign off every time a human touched an aircraft. Bonsu removed the external power cable, closed the access door, checked that it was secure, and held up an index finger, which was the Ruhar equivalent of a human thumbs-up sign. Saley acknowledged him with a thumbs-up, then Bonsu retreated with the power cable, retracting it into the cart. When the cart was safely out of the way, the Ruhar crew chief made a gesture of twirling an index finger in the air, the signal to start the engines. Derek Bonsu stood in his designated position behind the power cart, helmet on and hearing protection engaged, as he watched Saley run up the Dober's power, then take off smoothly. Derek had one hand on a fire extinguisher clipped to the side of the power cart, ready in case anything went wrong. Nothing would go wrong. All the pilots were skilled and diligent, and the aircraft were well maintained. The only potential problem Derek could foresee was that their supply of spare parts and consumable items was running low. The whole maintenance crew was concerned about the parts issue, and other airbases on Gitanu reported having the same problem. Under the terms of the ceasefire agreement, the Krestang Battle Group allowed the Ruhar to bring in supply ships, but the Ruhar government had been strangely stingy about shipping in anything other than medical supplies. Even before the Krestang Battle Group occupied the sky, Derek had heard rumors that the Ruhar federal government was considering negotiating away Gitanu in exchange for more valuable territory. Some Ruhar at the airbase said those negotiations were the reason they weren't getting critical spare parts. The government didn't plan on Ruhar being on Gitanu long-term. Derek didn't know what to think about such rumors, and he didn't think rumors mattered much anyway. As he watched Saley's aircraft join up with three others and race toward the eastern horizon, there was a brief flicker of light above them. It was sunlight, glinting off a Krestang warship in orbit. While the Krestang battle group was in orbit, the willingness of the Ruhar federal government to negotiate did not matter. One way or the other, the Krestang were going to take back control of the planet, and Derek Bonsu was going to be in as much trouble as all the other humans. More trouble, perhaps, because he had actively helped the Ruhar military. Derek would worry about that later, when he had to. What he most cared about now was that his next proficiency check flight in a Dobra was not for another 6 weeks, and he did not know how he could stand to wait that long to get back into the sky. Seeing Saley soaring away in the Dobra that he used to fly caused a physical pang of pain in his stomach. He looked again at the sky, seeing another flicker of light from a ship in the Krestang battle group. If the lizards retained control of Paradise, Derek knew he would never fly again. If he lived at all.
Chapter 14. Flying Dutchman. We jumped the Flying Dutchman into the far outskirts of the Paradise system, an area sparsely populated by chunks of dead, cold, dirty balls of ice and rock. From that distance, the star that shone on Paradise was a dim, fuzzy dot. A star, rather than a sun. Skippy reported we had emerged in a region with an ordinary density of hydrogen atoms. It was nothing to write home about. From our position, Paradise was 5 hours away, so the sensor data we had to work with was that old. In 4 hours, we would jump again, as the gamma-ray burst of our jump-in would be visible from Paradise, and we didn't want anyone coming out to investigate. We performed 6 jumps, with the latest coming in barely above the cloud tops on the far side of the system's only gas giant. By then, Skippy had determined that the only ships in the area were the Krestang in orbit around Paradise, and a handful of Ruhar ships were several light minutes away from the planet. By listening to message traffic both on the planet and between ships, Skippy was able to determine the situation had not changed significantly from what he had learned at the data relay station. The Krestang had over 20 warships plus support ships in orbit and complete supremacy in the space around Paradise. The remnants of the Ruhar Defense Task Force were licking their wounds. A truce had been offered by the Krestang commander and accepted by the Ruhar. There had not been any violations of the ceasefire, which surprised me. The Kristang had landed thousands of troops and heavy equipment, including aircraft, in a relatively uninhabited area of the northern continent. Humans isolated on Lemuria so far had been ignored by both sides. Although Skippy had intercepted messages from the Kristang warning UNEF to cease any and all cooperation with the Ruhar, and the Ruhar had removed or disabled farming equipment they had provided to UNEF. Without any assistance from the Ruhar, humans were reduced to plowing fields behind Hamvis and by dragon plows behind teams of soldiers. UNEF appeared to be on the verge of a split between those who favored loyalty to the Kristang and those who wished to be neutral or align with the Ruhar. Discipline was breaking down as UNEF became scattered groups of farm villages rather than a military force. Negotiations were still ongoing between the Ruhar and the Kristang, although the Kristang now had the upper hand and were pushing the Ruhar to finish the details quickly. According to message traffic between the Ruhar Commodore and the planetary government, the Ruhar Navy had contingency plans to send a major battle group to Paradise, but the Commodore advised that was highly unlikely. The Giraptha were concentrating on consolidating spectacular gains from their recent, highly successful offensive, and did not want to divert a substantial force for a planet their client species wanted to get rid of. Humans on Paradise, in short, were totally screwed unless we could do something to help them, without anyone ever knowing that we helped, or that we even existed. No problem, right? Joe, that is all the information I can get from here, Skippy complained, sounding frustrated. We need to go to Paradise. All I can do from so far away out here is decrypt signal traffic that leaks. Most of the top-secret message traffic that we needed was sent by tight-beam laser link transmission, and Skippy could only pick up those messages from faint scatter when the laser beam hit the atmosphere or dust particles in orbit. It was a true Skippy miracle that he was able to intercept any messages at all, and I gave him props for it. I know, Skippy. I'll talk to Chocula about it. Paradise. General Marcellus had to break the bad news to his boss. He was able to get 5 minutes on General Nivelle's calendar between meetings. As the acting UNEF chief of intelligence, it was Marcellus's job to know everything that was happening on Paradise. It was also his job to keep his boss informed of anything important. Marcellus didn't bother to sit down. Hopefully, the discussion wouldn't last long.
Sir, there was another incident last night. A British woman was assaulted.
Not again? Nivelle sighed heavily. That's the second time this week. Where? What happened?
Near the village of Churchill. She was assaulted.
He used a polite term.
Who did it?
Nivelle asked angrily. Marcellus could see a vein throbbing in the French general's forehead.
It appears to have been men in her own unit, sir.
Sacre bleu.
Other soldiers in the same village heard her screams and dealt with the situation before she could be seriously harmed,
Marcellus reported, although knowing that men in her own unit had assaulted her had to have caused serious emotional and psychological damage. Violence within the expeditionary force, while not widespread, was increasing. There were fights simply because people were bored and working too hard, and morale was low. There were fights over food, and there were sexual assaults. To protect against the latter, UNEF HQ had set up safe villages that only allowed women. That initiative had been a bad idea right from the start. It made the women of UNEF feel like second-class citizens. It made them question whether they could trust the men they served with. And as women who had been victims of violence or simply feared assault moved to the safe villages, the women outside such designated zones felt more and more isolated and vulnerable. The truth was, no one at UNEF HQ knew how to deal with the issue of sexual assault, or how to deal with many, if not most, of the critical problems that face the force every day. Not knowing whether the Ruhar or the Kristang would control the planet long-term prevented UNEF HQ from effectively making future plans. With the military situation still very much in flux, the force commanders understandably did not know what to do. General Marcellus had decided to deal with problems one day at a time.
There is a complication we need to address, General Nivelle. The men who broke up the assault killed the three attackers. However, it looks as if the attackers were killed sometime after the assault, not in the process of stopping the attack.
How long after?
1, perhaps 2 hours, Marcellus reported.
Nivelle's face was grim.
General Marcellus, I want there to be a swift investigation of this assault. I do not think, however, that it is necessary for there to be a deep inquiry into the subsequent events. Agreed?
Agreed, sir.
Flying Dutchman. Hans Chotek approved us going to paradise, only because Skippy was going to bring one end of a micro-wormhole with us in the shuttle so we could be in constant, instantaneous communication.
Joe, I can tell you, Skippy said privately, that micro-wormholes can be rather complicated, delicate things, and they can suddenly shut down for no reason, if you know what I mean. I figured I would keep that in my back pocket for use in an emergency. When I say us going to paradise, I mean Skippy and me. No way was I going to miss out on this mission. It was way too important. I needed to be right there seeing what was going on, making decisions in real time. To my surprise, Chotek quickly agreed, as long as all major decisions were reviewed by him. That left me suspicious that he just wanted me off the ship, but by then I was past caring. Going on the mission would be me, Skippy, Adams, and Captain Desai as our pilot. Just the four of us. Three humans and a beer can in one of our smaller type of dropships. We would not be bringing along any of the Spec Ops troops, and on that issue Chotek and I agreed, although for different reasons. My reasoning was that if a situation required combat troops, we were in way over our heads and needed to get away from Paradise. Chotek's reasoning was that if I had Spec Ops troops on Paradise with me, I would be tempted to use them in some risky mission. He didn't trust my judgment. That is why UNEF Command sent him to the stars with us, so he was only doing his job. Anyway, it worked out well for both of us. Adams came along on the mission. I forget who suggested her first, me or Chotek. Count Chocula probably figured that Adams's level-headed practical nature would keep me out of trouble. My reason for including her was that she had been on Paradise, that she had been with the Merry Band of Pirates since the beginning, and she knew me, and knew how I think. Also, I wanted someone to talk with, because we might be on Paradise for a while. During the flight down to Paradise, Captain Desai would fly the dropship in a maximum stealth flight profile. Since I was technically qualified to fly that type of dropship, my job was to sit in the co-pilot seat. Skippy joked that Adams's job would be to shoot me if I tried to touch any of the controls. I hope Skippy was joking about that. The other reason our mission included only three humans and a beer can was that we flew down to Paradise in one of our smaller dropships. Even the small Theranan dropship was the size of a Boeing 67, and it could accommodate 16 people after we tore out the original Theranan seats and replaced them with something that could fit a human. 16 people could fit, but they couldn't be comfortable. In order to get to Paradise, we had to fly most of the way there in the dropship. We couldn't risk the Flying Dutchman jumping in anywhere close to the planet. That meant the travel time after leaving the Dutchman was 8 days. 8 days in a dropship with two other people and one bathroom that was sized for little green men. We jumped out of the star system entirely and then spent nearly an hour with the star carrier accelerating to the proper velocity and direction. Then we jumped the Dutchman back in, still far away from Paradise. Our dropship quickly launched and the Dutchman was away again, accelerating at maximum thrust in normal space. A pirate ship could not jump again because that would break the micro-wormhole we relied on for communications. The speed boost we'd gotten from the ship meant that our dropship didn't need to use any fuel to get to Paradise, only to slow down once we got there. Our dropship was wrapped in a stealth field, plus Skippy showed us a new trick, wherein he warped space-time between us and the planet, which helped mask the energy of the dropship's engines as we decelerated before hitting the atmosphere. One reason we needed to preserve fuel is that our entry could not be the usual burning streak through the atmosphere of most descents. We needed our presence to be secret. Skippy was of course able to mask the dropship from the sensors of both Ruhar and Kristang, but anyone simply looking out a viewport of a ship would see the superheated light of us plunging down through the atmosphere. Our stealth field was on and operating perfectly as it could in an atmosphere. So we came in slow, using engine power to slow down and then lower us gradually. That burned up a whole lot of fuel. It worked. Plus, we came in at night, over the ocean far to the west of any inhabited land, and there was heavy cloud cover from 12 kilometers almost all the way to the deck. Almost skimming the wave tops and flying subsonic so turbulence of our passage through the air could not be detected, we came over land. Skippy selected a spot in the mountains near the equator. The lush rainforest jungle there provided good cover to supplement the stealth field, and the location was not under any regular flight paths. The first thing I did after we landed was go behind a tree and pee without having to kneel and bump my head in the tiny Theranan bathroom of the dropship. Then we set up a tent. Whoever was on duty could be in the tent sheltered from the daily rain showers, while we would use the climate-controlled dropship for sleeping, cooking, and eating.
"It's strange to be back here," Adam said, staring off into the distance after we got the tent set up.
"Yeah," I agreed. "It was strange to be back." When I closed my eyes, the scent of the tropics was exactly the same as what I had experienced when I was stationed at the launcher. That made sense. We were only 500 kilometers from the launcher base complex. For a moment, I just stood there and let the memories wash over me. Adams sighed wistfully.
"We both have a lot of people we know on Paradise, and we can't contact any of them. I feel like I went back from my high school reunion, but I'm hiding in the bushes, looking through the window."
"Sergeant, I feel the same way. We can't contact anyone, in any way that might reveal our presence here." I said that to remind myself more than her. What would I do if I learned that someone I knew was in trouble and I could help? I couldn't help, period. We were back on Paradise for a specific mission, and after that mission was complete, we were leaving, without any of our old friends knowing we had ever been there. That sucked. But so did the whole situation for UNEF. If our mission was successful, we could help improve things for UNEF. Then I called Chotek to check in and get his approval for the next phase of the operation. Skippy began marauding through computer systems of the Ruhar and the Kristang even before we landed, and as I finished setting up the tent, Adams told me Skippy had found important information. First, of course, both sides detected the Dutchman jumping in and then not jumping out again. Neither side has been able to identify the type of ship, and speculation is running that it is a rival Kristang clan monitoring the situation on Paradise in case there is an opportunity to screw the Swift Arrow clan out of the planet. Anyway, the good news is that no one suspects our pirate ship is involved, and no one is interested in chasing after it. They also have no idea we landed. As to what has been going on here, well, this is odd, Skippy reported. As you requested, Joe, I checked on people you know first. You will be happy to hear that everyone on your list is alive and well. It was a short list. Still, every one of them have survived. What is odd is that they all are or were being held by the Ruhar. What? Why? I am sure you will be surprised to learn that at one particular facility are Emily Perkins, Shauna Jarrett, Dave Chaika, and Jesse Coulter. Shauna is with Cornpone and Ski? He was correct. I was completely surprised by that. Emily Perkins, do you mean Major Perkins, the intel officer? Her first name had never come up in conversation, but then our conversations had been limited to me passing on very bad news from the Burgermeister. Correct, Major Emily Perkins, Skippy confirmed. The four of them have been held by the Ruhar for months. At another facility were Sergeant Greg Cook and the three members of the fire team you led at the village of Tescor, Baker, Chen, and Sanchez. Also with them are three people who were with you on the day that the Ruhar attacked Fort Arrow: Amaro, Pope, and Rogan. I don't understand. Why is Sergeant Coke with them? And what is Shauna doing with Dave and Jesse? The grouping of people was random, according to records of the Ruhar. They picked people up wherever they were and brought them to the closest Ruhar military base. Pick them up, why? The Ruhar interrogated everyone who knew you personally on Paradise, Joe. They know that you broke out of prison and flew away in a stolen dodo. It is not surprising that the Ruhar are intensely curious about how you managed to do that. It would be very surprising if the Ruhar had not investigated the incident. The first thing they did was interrogate all the people at Major Sims's logistics base. After that proved fruitless, they moved on to other potential sources. No one told the Ruhar anything because no one on Paradise knows anything. The Ruhar have concluded that the humans they interrogated likely do not have any useful information. Sergeant Koch and his group were released already. They're on a train bound for Lemuria now. Major Perkins and the other three were officially released 3 days ago. They are currently waiting for transportation. A train will be stopping for them tomorrow morning. Were they treated well by the Ruhar? I asked anxiously. Yes, Joe. Except for a bland diet, they were not harmed in any way. The Ruhar kept them safer than they would have been on Lemuria. Your old friend the Burgermeister took a personal interest in them. She is still here? As the deputy administrator or something? Indeed, she is. Joe, she knows the Ruhar government is negotiating to give the planet back to the Kristang. She is personally opposed to the idea, because she sees it as a betrayal of the native population who have built homes and lives here. She is also powerless to do much about it, other than to scold her government for selling out their own people. Based on conversations she has had with the Ruha Commodore, who commands the small task force here, she does appreciate why the Ruha fleet does not want the responsibility of defending such a relatively isolated and unimportant planet. Good. She was always straight with me. They're going to be on a train, huh? That complicates things. I want to give our message about the projectors to Chaika and Coulter. Sergeant Kolk was with too many people who I didn't know as well. We served in combat together. I know them, and I trust them.
That's no good, sir, Adams declared.
You said that whoever we contact can't ever know that you were involved. Anyone else but you would logically contact Major Perkins first. She's an officer and an intel expert. The other three may be your friends, but they are low-ranking soldiers. They wouldn't be the first to receive an important communication like this. The only reason someone would contact Chaika or Coulter instead of Perkins would be a personal relationship with those two. They know that you, me, Chang, and Desai survived the hit in our jail, and they know the four of us flew away in a stolen dodo. We can't do anything that may make them guess that any of us are involved. We need to contact Perkins first.
Yeah, Joe. What do you think of that? Skippy asked gleefully. You're not so smart after all, huh? Sarge Marge is right. This message needs to come from an unnamed source.
Skippy, come on. We can't do the trick again where we pretend you are some top-secret UNEF cyber unit. Perkins knows that there aren't any humans on Paradise with the technology.
Not humans, Adams said.
Ruhar. We hint to Perkins that the source of the message about hidden projectors is a group of native Ruhar. Ruhar who know their government is pulling the rug out from under them and they can't go to their own military for action. The natives want to knock out that Krestang battle group, so they get a group of humans to do it for them. That way, if the operation goes south, they can deny the whole thing.
I was stunned. Holy shit, Adams. That is a genius idea. How did you think of that?
She cocked her head at me.
I didn't. It's an old idea. What do you do if you're weak and you want to defeat a superior force?
That was an easy one. I didn't even need to consult the Army Field Manual.
You engage in guerrilla warfare.
That, or you do it the easy way, Adams explained. You get a bunch of lobbyists and celebrities to persuade our government to send in the U.S. Army to do the fighting for you.
Ain't that the truth? I offered Adams a fist bump, and she took it.
That is a good idea. Perkins will certainly be ready to believe it. She was in Nigeria and a couple other trouble spots before that.
Damn, I said admiringly. That is a good idea, Sergeant. Of course the native Ruha would want to disrupt negotiations, and surely some rumors have gotten out.
Agreed. We contact Major Perkins.
I thought for a moment what the message should say.
I bit my lip.
I can compose a message, but I need to make sure I don't write it in language that people will recognize as mine.
No problem, Joe, Skippy said cheerily. No one will know the message is from you, unless the message starts with, duh, how about this? Or if it has terrible grammar and it rambles on and on forever before finally getting to the freaking point.
I ramble on and on.
What about... We're not talking about me here, Joe, Skippy said hastily. Don't try to change the subject. Just don't write the message like a fourth grader, and don't use any of your horrible Maine Yankee slang, like...
And he changed his voice. By golly, but Jesus, I mowed down that lobster dinner. It was a goddamn feast, I tell ya.
Oh my God, Skippy. You sounded just like my father's Uncle Virgil, I laughed.
He had even correctly pronounced God with a T sound on the end, the way God intended.
Also, Skippy cautioned, don't call a milkshake a frappe, for heaven's sake.
A frappe has ice cream in it, a milkshake doesn't, I retorted.
And if you're in Rhode Island, a frappe is called a cabinet. Everybody knows that, right, Adams?
I'm not from New England, sir, so I'm with Skippy on this one. We should have Skippy compose the message, then we can look at it.
I had to admit that was a better idea.
Write something up, Skippy, please.
Oh, my shoulders slumped. We'll need Chotek to approve it.
Crap. This operation was too complicated.
Skippy composed three messages in like a billionth of a nanosecond, and they all looked good to me. Then the wheels of bureaucracy moved at lightning speed, and Chotek gave us his preferred text with minor annoying revisions the next morning. Skippy was not happy about the delay, although we didn't plan to send the message to Perkins until that afternoon anyway when she and the three others were on the train.
I provided a micro wormhole for crying out loud, Skippy complained.
A true miracle of technology, something no one else in the galaxy has. It allows instantaneous, undetectable communication between us and a starship several light minutes away. And what does that jerk do with it? He takes 14 hours to send us back a message, and he insists on changing 4 words. 4 freaking words, Joe!
Skippy, I hear you. I was pissed about it, too. Sometimes managers think they have to change at least something in order to feel useful.
Yeah, well, in that case, I am sad to report that the micro-wormhole is acting up already. We could lose contact with Chocula, I mean, the ship, at any moment, if you know what I mean.
Not yet, Skippy, I told him, and then remembered other people were listening. That is terrible news about the wormhole. Do what you can to keep it open.
Oh, I get it, Joe. Sure, sure. I'm working on it. Just let me know.
Skippy was an ancient, super-powerful, super-intelligent being. He also sucked at lying.
Once the Ruhar announced that they were being released, Perkins and the others hoped they would be given their Z-phones back, but it didn't happen. Even when they got on the train, no Z-phones. Jesse and Dave were going crazy that someone might have stolen or messed with their couch, which Perkins could not understand. What could be so important about a couch? The train was nothing special. 2 passenger cars tacked on the front end of a freight train just behind the engine. Both cars were well-worn, with the seats made of some super-tough gel material. The 4 humans were told to take the front car, which had most of its seats piled high with baggage and equipment. There were no Ruhar in the front car, an arrangement that suited both species. As they walked past the second car, Ruhar crowded the windows, gawking at the strange humans or glaring at the clients of their enemy, the Kristang. One of the Ruhar, a male who had a child in his arms, shook his fist at the 4 humans. Dave Chaika took exception to that.
Hey, screw, Chaika, Major Perkins scolded.
Eyes forward. To these Ruhar, we are the enemy. We came here to throw them off this planet that has been their home for generations. If I were them, I would hate us.
Yes, ma'am.
Chaika looked at the ground. They boarded the car, squeezed between boxes and baggage, and found seats to spread out. Enough room for each of them to lay down. Dave walked over to Perkins.
Sorry, ma'am. I lost my temper.
It happens. Perkins shrugged.
Chaika, these people, she used that word instead of Ruhar or hamster, have lived here long enough that their parents, even grandparents, are buried here. They put down roots on this planet. This is their home. Then we showed up, working for the Kristang, to throw them off their world. They have been at war since before humans discovered fire. They have only known this war. Think about that.
Yes, ma'am. All the Ruhar I have met personally have been nice, just ordinary people. He used that word intentionally.
I don't hate them. I hate being here. I hate not being home.
We all do.
My folks must be worried sick, she said, blinking away a tear.
They could be trapped on Paradise forever, and that was the best scenario. If the Ruhar kept control of Paradise, humans there would be prisoners of war. If the Kristang took over the planet, the humans there would become slaves, if they survived at all. Perkins felt like indulging in a good cry, which would have made her feel better. Under stress, women tended to cry it away. Men tended to get angry and lash out. The way women handled stress, Perkins thought, was healthier. The male-dominated army generally considered crying to be a weakness. So she swallowed hard and looked Dave in the eye.
We all want to go home. Until then, we all have to do our jobs and take care of each other.
Yes, ma'am, Dave said. I'm going to check on that water tank. He pointed to the corner near the car's single bathroom. If they were going to be on the train all the way to Lemuria, it was going to be a very long trip.
After a lunch of nutrient mush that the humans had gulped down as quickly as possible, a Ruhar soldier came through the train with a bag, and from it, he pulled 4 Z-phones. It was like Christmas and a birthday all at once. Shauna almost shivered with delight, then turned to Perkins.
Is it okay if we use the phones, ma'am? Can we tell people about Bishop?
Jesse asked anxiously.
Go ahead, soldier. I plan to use my phone right away, Perkins said. No restrictions on talking about Bishop, as little as we know. It's not a secret to the Ruhar. It shouldn't be a secret to us either.
The other 3 scattered about the train car for privacy. There were plenty of seats. Perkins first checked her texts and emails. She naturally had thousands of eats that had piled up in her absence, so she started with the most recent
and intended to work her way backward. Suddenly, all of her messages and emails disappeared, except for one text and one email. The text told her to open the email. So she did, and received a shock. She instructed the Z-phone to call the U.S. Army Intel Chief directly. Perkins had not been involved in intelligence gathering or analysis for over 6 months. She had become a farmer, like almost all of the humans on Paradise. With UNEF no longer a fighting force, the only useful information was about crop yields and which people had gotten into fights. General Marcellus, she knew, was currently acting as the chief intelligence officer for UNEF HQ. If the message she had received was true, he would surely know something. He answered right away, which was surprising.
"Who is this?"
He sounded annoyed, and there were other voices in the background.
"Major Perkins, sir, 3rd Infantry. I was on your HQ intel staff until recently. Thank you for taking my call."
"Oh, yes, Major. My phone picked up by itself somehow. It is darn good to hear from you. Did the Ruha treat you well? We tried to contact you, but the Ruha wouldn't allow it."
"Yes, the Ruha treated us well. They just gave us our phones back. We were released 3 days ago and we're now on a train headed for Lemuria. Sir, I have information that you should hear directly."
"Wait a minute."
He went into a quieter area or closed the door because the background voices faded.
"Go ahead, Major."
"The Ruha brought us in for questioning about Joe Bishop. They say he escaped from that Kristang jail. That as far as the Ruha know, he is alive somewhere."
"We figured that was why they brought you in. We looked at the list of people they took and put two and two together. The only thing you all had in common was Bishop. Are the Ruha still telling the story about him flying away in a stolen dodo?"
"Yes, sir," she replied, surprised. "You knew about that?"
"There have been rumors since the Ruha took the planet back," he explained. "Then they released other people a couple days ago, including the staff of a logistics base that Bishop supposedly recruited people and supplies from. Perkins, you know Bishop. You were his contact when that Logelia woman was feeding him info about the wormholes and all that. Do you think he was capable of stealing and flying an alien spacecraft?"
"No human had been trained to fly a dropship, and those ships surely had security features to prevent theft or mischief. The two members of his original fire team told me they would be surprised if Bishop could operate an iPad without breaking it." "I don't see it, sir. Bishop is smart and resourceful, but he's not that smart."
"That's what we're thinking also. Bishop supposedly told the people at the logistics base that he was on a mission to hit the Kristang, and at the time there weren't any Kristang left on this planet. To hit them, Bishop would have to go into space. After being in that Kristang jail, I can see why he'd look for an opportunity to get some payback. For my money, I'll bet that dropship was flown by Ruha, and for some reason they needed humans to come along."
"If that was a Ruha mission," Perkins added, "why would the Ruha be asking us about it now?"
"Major, I am sure that humanity is not the only species where the right hand sometimes doesn't know what the left hand is doing," he explained. "If this was a secret Ruha mission, the Ruha in charge here on Paradise may not know anything about it. Or it was a rogue operation, and the Ruha command is keeping it quiet out of embarrassment."
Marcellus knew he was assigning human emotions and motivations to an alien species, but his extensive contact with the Ruha told him that he wouldn't be far off the truth.
"I'm glad to hear you are safe and well. I have a meeting in 5 minutes.
"Bishop wasn't my only information, sir, or the most important."
"Go ahead, Major."
"Sir, I heard a rumor from the Ruha. The Ruha federal government has been negotiating to give this planet back to the Kristang. They're trading it for more valuable territory."
The half-second lag before General Marcellus answered told Emily Perkins everything she needed to know. The message she had received was the truth, and UNEF HQ knew.
"Son of a bitch."
"Major, that is one hell of a rumor," he lied. "I can't see the Ruha doing that. They have fought to retake this place, and now to keep it. I wouldn't put any credence in rumors like that. We have enough bad news that is true."
"Yes, sir."
"Where are you headed?"
"Wherever this train takes us. The Ruha told us we would eventually be going back to where we were living when they picked us up, but I think all they care about is that we're in Lemuria, so that the humans would no longer be the responsibility of the Ruha."
"Probably by boat, then. Contact my staff when you're ashore, and I'll arrange to have you brought to HQ. We'll need to debrief you."
"I'll bet you do," Perkins thought. "You want me someplace where you can be sure that I won't repeat what I heard about the Ruha selling the planet out from under us."
Thank you, sir.
Of course, all of Perkins's calls now went through the Skippytel network, so we heard her conversation with General Marcellus. When she made the call, we were all inside the dropship because it was absolutely pouring down rain outside and had been all morning. Also, it had been my turn to cook, and I had made blueberry muffins, which we were leisurely munching on while drinking coffee. There wasn't much else for us to do at the moment. When Perkins ended the call, Desai tapped me on the shoulder.
Sir, we could use what Marcellus said.
Huh? Maybe my brain was extra slow that morning.
He thinks us flying in away in a Ruhar Dodo was a Ruhar operation. That we were along for the ride, we should use that. Play it up.
Skippy, Desai asked, do the Ruhar have an intelligence service that is separate from the military?
You mean like the American CIA and NSA?
Yes, they do. The Ruhar have two rival intelligence agencies. One is nominally civilian and one is sort of part of the military. They both run clandestine operations that the other agency doesn't know about, and the military spy agency is notorious for acting without the military leadership's knowledge. The Ruhar military spy people are referred to by the Ruhar equivalent of cowboys. In this case, cowboy does not mean a rugged outdoorsman. It means amateurs who shoot first and think later.
How could that help us? I asked Desai, wondering if this was how Skippy felt when I was explaining one of my ideas.
Sir, the Ruhar know we flew away in a Ruhar dropship, and by now the Kristang have probably heard about it also.
They have, Skippy confirmed.
The Kristang may be putting two and two together, Desai explained. They now know that a Ruhar dropship left Paradise with humans on it. Back then, Skippy told the Kristang that the Dodo had been stolen by Kristang, which is why the Kristang sent ships in to pick us up. Then the frigate that picked us up disappeared, and the Star Carrier that was the frigate's mothership also disappeared. If the Kristang ever begin to suspect that humans were involved in that, we would be in deep trouble.
Aha, Adams agreed. We need the Kristang to think the whole thing, stealing a Dodo and flying away, was a secret Ruhar operation to capture a Kristang ship?
Exactly, Desai smiled.
And now, I did know how Skippy felt.
Damn it, I'm the commander. I should have thought of that. It was freaking brilliant.
Wow, Skippy said admiringly. That is devious. Keep both sides guessing who did it, and neither of them will ever consider that lowly humans could have run the operation. Joe, you are not the only devious mind here.
If you like, I can plant hints in Ruhar databases that the four of you escaping from jail and stealing a Dodo was a secret Ruhar operation.
That would be great, Skippy. Desai, that was good thinking.
Wait. I had an unpleasant thought.
Skippy, before you do anything, you need to clear this with Chotek.
Oh, for crying out loud, Skippy complained. I heard a great idea. It wasn't yours, but it did come from a monkey. Ugh.
No offense, Major Desai.
No offense taken, Mr. Skippy.
Desai beamed.
I'm proud to be what you consider a monkey, especially since your definition of monkey seems to be primates who think of ideas that your brain can't handle.
What? Oh, that's it, Captain Desai. Your name has been added to my list, Skippy warned. You filthy monkeys think you are so smart, he grumbled.
Apparently, I offered Desai a high five and she accepted. We are so smart. Anyway, back to my point, Skippy. We need to run this by Chotek. This is why he came out here. Desai thought of a way to prevent both the Ruhar and Kristang from ever suspecting humans could be involved in how the Flower and the Flying Dutchman disappeared. Chotek should be thrilled to hear it, and that should demonstrate to him and to UNEF Command how valuable it is to have the merry band of pirates out here.
Oh, fine. What a pain in the ass, Skippy muttered.
I'll wait for the Count to make the obvious decision, which seems to be what human managers do.
Sir, Adams spoke up. I agree with what you said, except for one thing.
What? I asked.
This pirate is not very merry right now.
She pointed to the table in front of me.
You ate the last muffin.
Chapter 15. After Perkins ended the call with Marcellus, she read the message again, twice, before sending a reply. She asked who the message had come from and why she should trust them. Another message came almost immediately. Think of us as your mysterious benefactor, the message read. You can trust us because we're the only ones telling you the truth, and we are your only hope of freeing this planet from the Kristang. You are our first choice, but we have other options. You need us. Emily Perkins could not find fault with that argument. She and the mysterious benefactor, who she decided to call Embi for short, went back and forth for 10 minutes until she had no more questions to ask. Embi had answered some of her questions and declined to answer others. The intelligence officer in her suspected that Embi was a group of Ruhar native to Paradise who wanted to prevent their own government from selling the planet out from under them. They couldn't take action by themselves and they couldn't trust their own military, so they were using humans, who were even more desperate to prevent the Kristang from permanently regaining control of the planet. It was one hell of a story Embi had told. If she agreed to go along, they would tell her more. They would tell her at each point during the mission only what she needed to know. Perkins liked that. It gave her some confidence that Embi knew what they were doing. "I'm in," she sent back. "What is the next step?" "We will get you off the train and secure the transport and equipment you need," Embi replied. "You will be leaving the train tonight after you are supposed to be asleep. Your next step is to persuade your team to join you." "Sure," thought Perkins, "no problem. Before I can persuade Jarrett, Chaika, and Coulter to join me, I will need to convince them that I'm not crazy, and that this isn't a joke."
"A secret mission," Jesse cocked his head skeptically.
"What, are we going off-world to find Bishop? Something like that?"
"No, this has nothing to do with Bishop," Perkins said, surprised. She hadn't thought of Bishop at all. "I don't know where he went, where he is, or whether he's still alive. I don't even know if the Ruhar told us the truth. Maybe he did escape from that jail, and the Ruhar are looking for him. The story of him stealing a dropship and flying away on a secret mission? That I find hard to believe," Perkins frowned. "I have to warn you. This mission is not authorized by UNEF. They don't know about it, and they likely wouldn't authorize it if they knew. Does anyone have a problem with that?"
Jesse looked out the window to the landscape of the alien planet passing by. A planet he was trapped on, and a planet that would soon be controlled by the cruel Kristang.
"UNEF got us out here because they didn't know the truth and were too stupid to ask."
He looked the former intelligence officer in the eye as he spoke.
"Now I'm a farmer on an alien planet, and there is no way I can ever go home. I say to hell with UNEF. They've screwed everything up so far."
"Amen to that, brother," Dave agreed.
"I have no problem with it either, Major. But we will need weapons, and we don't have any."
"We won't need weapons," Perkins explained. "This is going to seem odd, but what we need is drilling gear, excavation equipment."
"Excavation equipment, like digging?" Dave asked.
"Man, if this is about us trying to find gold or something like that, I'm going to be very disappointed."
"Gold?" Shauna asked. "Are we hoping to find gold so the Ruha will think this planet is more valuable, so they'll send their fleet here to chase away the Kristang?"
"No." Perkins shook her head in frustration.
"No gold. If the Ruha want gold, they mine it from asteroids. This isn't about anything like gold."
"Then what is it about, ma'am?" Jesse asked with his arms across his chest.
"You asked us to trust you. I'd appreciate you trusting us."
"Fair enough, Coulter. I don't know the whole story. Whoever is running this operation has me on a need-to-know basis also." As Perkins said that, she wondered if Embi was listening through her Z-phone. Probably they were, she decided. Before telling the three about the mission, she forwarded to them a message from Embi. Their mysterious benefactor had told her that anyone who opened that message would have absolutely unbreakable encryption on their phones. Perkins had been instructed to forward the message to anyone involved in the operation and not to anyone else.
"I'm going to tell you everything I know, so here it is. When we got these Z-phones," she held hers up, "I had a ton of email. Then it all disappeared, except for one. I opened it to find a message from someone calling themselves our mysterious benefactor. I'm calling them Embi for short. They didn't say who they are, but I'm betting they're a group of native Ruhar who are not happy with the situation on this planet, and they can't trust their own government or military to take the appropriate action, so they're trusting us. What they want us to do is get rid of that Kristang battle group in orbit." She pointed to the sky. "So what they want matches what is best for us. That's the only reason I agreed to take on this mission. That plus I don't see any other possibility of humans surviving on this planet long term. If the Kristang take over this planet permanently, none of us will live very long. I think you all know that."
"I do, ma'am," Shauna said. "But tell me, please. You got a mysterious email. That's what all this is about? Could it be a prank?"
"Yeah," Jesse added. "Or disinformation? You intel types do that kind of stuff.
This could be the Kristang trying to get us to do something stupid against them so they have an excuse to squash us like bugs.
That would be just like the lizards, Dave observed.
No, Perkins shook her head. The message contained intel I didn't know, and when I contacted the U.S. intel chief, he denied it. He denied it in a way that was way too quick, you understand? UNFHQ had this info, they know about it, and they haven't told us. Whoever our mysterious benefactor is, they know.
They know what?
What is it they know? Shauna was the first to ask. So Perkins told them. Told them how the Ruhar federal government had been negotiating to trade Paradise to the Kristang in exchange for more valuable territory. How the Ruhar fleet had never intended to recapture the planet in the first place. How that was why there had not been giant transport ships bringing evacuated Ruhar back to their home. Why the local Ruhar administration had not put more than token effort into rebuilding infrastructure.
Holy shit, Dave said quietly. Those motherfuckers.
The Ruhar are selling us out.
Yes, Perkins agreed flatly. There was talk going around 6 to 8 months ago of UNEF declaring loyalty to the Ruhar.
She could see everyone's eyes grow wide with surprise. HQ thought that might give the Ruhar more incentive to protect us from the Kristang raids that were burning out our crops. Then suddenly, that talk stopped, and we were told by HQ not to mention it again. Now I know why. HQ must have talked to the Ruhar, and the hamsters told us no. They didn't want our loyalty because then they'd be responsible for us, and they plan to leave us behind when they trade this planet away.
Shit, Jesse said, stunned. I'm not dumb enough to think the Ruhar would ever be our buddies, but I didn't think they would screw us like this.
We don't have any friends out here, people, Perkins declared. We're on our own. Truly on our own, because the Kristang have lost contact with Earth. The Ruhar confirmed that to me. The only reason I agreed to work with Embi on this mission is that our goals match in this case. We both want those Kristang ships out of orbit.
Ma'am, in the long run, what good does that do for us? Shauna asked.
The Ruhar still plan to sell the planet out from under us?
Yeah, that's why I asked Embi the same question. And that's why I think our mysterious benefactor is a group of native Ruhar, because what Embi told me is that once that Kristang battle group isn't hanging over our heads, there is at least a possibility the federal Ruhar government could somehow be persuaded to keep Paradise. With the Kristang having the big guns in orbit, there is no possibility the Ruhar will keep this place in the long term.
Okay, Jesse said after taking a deep breath. So the mission is to get rid of a Kristang task force of what? More than 20 warships? Did this MB say how the four of us are going to do that?
Coulter, if you think I've told you some incredible shit so far.
Perkins smiled and tilted her head.
You ain't heard anything yet.
Wait, ma'am, Jesse said a few minutes later, his head spinning. There are giant maser cannons buried on this planet that the Kristang don't know about?
That the Kristang clan in orbit do not know. The Kristang clan that installed the projectors do know. But that group of Kristang is not here.
Right, Jesse said, thinking that keeping track of who was who in this war required a color-coded spreadsheet.
The Kristang here don't know, and the Ruhar government and military don't know, and UNEF doesn't know. But some of the native Ruhar do know?
Exactly.
How? Jesse insisted. How do a bunch of native hamster farmers know all this when their government and military don't?
Perkins shrugged.
Maybe some farmer was plowing a field and dug up a projector by accident. I don't know. And Demby didn't tell me how they found out about the projectors. It doesn't matter. What I do know is that the Ruhar government and military do not know, because they certainly would have used the projectors to stop the raids. Now, if the Ruhar government learned of the projectors, they would not use them against a full Kristang task force because that would sour the negotiations. What this MB wants is a shooting war between the Ruhar and the Kristang. They want to force their government's hand. As long as that Kristang task force is in orbit, the native Ruhar are screwed. They can't trust their own government to do the right thing, so they're using us to do it for them.
I am pretty damn sick of people using us for their own ends. She looked her three soldiers in the eyes and found complete agreement. But in this case, what they want is what we want. We can't tell UNFHQ because the Ruhar and Kristang have totally compromised the Z-Phone network. It's up to us to reactivate these projectors and knock those ships out of orbit.
Do you mind if I say holy shit, ma'am? Shauna asked, her mind still reeling. You can say it for me too, Jarrett, Perkins smiled. I've had time to think about it and it's still blowing my mind. When the Ruhar hit Earth, she reminisced, I was on leave on a camping trip in Kentucky with friends. There was no cell phone service at the lake. We didn't see anything going on in the sky because it rained that morning. I didn't find out that Earth had been attacked by aliens until we hiked out 2 days later. Christ, that was one hell of a shock. Then I went into space, found out that the Kristang aren't our allies after all, that our way back to Earth has been cut off, and that the Ruhar are looking to trade this planet for a set of steak knives. So, when a mystery group tells me that we can destroy starships in orbit using secret maser cannons, I say, why the hell not? That isn't even the strangest thing that's happened to me this month. Amen to that, Dave said, and bumped fists with Jesse. I'm in. You sure, man? Jesse asked. Yeah, what the hell? Dave frowned. By the time we get back, someone will have stolen our couch anyway. I'm in if you are, Jesse said, looking at Shauna. Shauna didn't hesitate. She wanted combat duty, she wanted to make a difference, and this was her opportunity. Somebody else could grow tomatoes in Lemuria. Sign me up, ma'am, she saluted Perkins. What are we going to do for weapons? The Ruhar were careful to collect even the plastic spoons that came with their twice-a-day servings of nutrient mush. Perkins was relieved and anxious. She had a team. Now she had the responsibility to execute the mission she'd accepted. Emby says we won't need weapons. What we need is transport, and like I said, excavation equipment. These projectors